back with you midweek Wednesday, March 10th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. Critical Thinking, our 3 o'clock guest at the bottom of the hour, a local Connecticut college professor, has a new book on that. He says, we don't teach kids enough in college in particular about critical thinking and how to use it. Garrett Sheehan joined us in the 4 o'clock hour, the head of the Greater New Haven Chamber of Commerce, to talk about how area businesses in the Elm City are rebounding after COVID-19. And Republican Fairfield State Senator Tony Wong joined us in the 5 o'clock hour to update us on some bills being discussed at the state capitol that would target local zoning laws in the state. Talk about, as I like to talk about on this show all the time, because it's very, I just think it's one of the huge issues that a lot of people are not paying attention to today, is what's going on in America's colleges and universities and in our educational system in general. What is going on with educating and teaching kids, folks there, guys and gals, whose mothers, grandmothers, grandfathers, step-parents are paying, in many cases, thousands of dollars a year to educate them. How well are they thinking? How well can they step beyond these rigid limits of thinking and really solve problems? Dr. Stephen J. Proman is a Connecticut College professor. New book out, America's Critical Thinking Crisis, The Failure and the Promise of Education. Dr. Proman, it's Paul here at WICC in Bridgeport. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on the show for this important topic.
Yeah, and thanks for writing this. Dr. Perlman, first of all, before we get deeply into this, for folks who may not be so steeped in this, when you use the phrase critical thinking and a critical thinking crisis, what do you mean?
That's a great question, and there's no one simple way to define that. The fact of the matter is, or the more unfortunate way to look at it, is that no matter how we are defining critical thinking, whether it's a facet of problem solving or decision making, whether it's a matter of being able to analyze and evaluate material or read critically or take in the news critically or what have you, any of the definitions that are being put out for critical thinking are unfortunately not being accomplished by the school system.
And why is that, Dr. Perlman? Is it this culture we're in now? Is it a failure to formally and properly educate guys and gals? Is there something missing? Is there a link in the chain not being used here?
There sure is. Well, a number of links are being missed in the chain. And I want to preface this because I think it's very important to note that I in no way fault educators for this. Educators work very hard and for too little appreciation. They need more support. And what we're talking about instead is a failure of the paradigm of education that we have in the United States, and it's an old one relative to the world. But the fact of the matter is that it's predicated on the acquisition of knowledge instead of the teaching of how to process that knowledge, instead of the teaching of how to think critically about the world, about information. And we have educators, even through K-12, who receive training in how to teach, but certainly at the higher education level and up, where they don't receive any training in how to teach at all. We have educators who are never taught how to teach students to think critically. And so they approach it in ways that they all think are popularly working. Mm-hmm. But when we bore down into the research on this issue, we discover that, in fact, student critical thinking skills, at best, generally don't improve over the course of college.
So when you talk, Dr. Perlman, about a critical thinking skill, give us an example. Is it intuition? Is it a gut feeling? Is it looking at problems away from the toolbox, say the book or the taught lesson in school, and trying to get an interesting approach to it? What is all that?
Sure. It's a broad question, but let's take an example. So for one example that's very simple, we know that when students are taught to read, for the most part, they're taught to read to acquire what the text is saying. And that's valuable. We have to understand what a text is saying, but they come away with the main messages of that text or the main points that an author might make. What they're not taught to do, conversely, which is what we need to teach them to do, is to interrogate how well a text makes its point by separating claims and evidence, by evaluating the text. And what we know from extensive research on this is that when students are taught to read a text so as to pierce inside of it and not take in what it's saying as information, but rather to pierce how well it constructs information or attempts to construct information, that not only do they understand the text better and get those main messages better, but they get deeper, more insightful understandings of the text. And they also, their learning persists longer, their understanding is more complex, and they also are not as typically inclined to take that information as gospel truth.
Dr. Stephen J. Perlman is the guest. Doctor, hang on. We're going to do a quick break. We'll come right back with you. Name of the book, America's Critical Thinking Crisis, The Failure and Promise of Education. More with Dr. Perlman coming up. First, though, traffic and weather together right here, 3:36 on WICC. And what we're talking about, hopefully Darianne is agreeing with us, or maybe not, or Ansonia, Derby, Shelton, Bridgeport. We're talking about critical thinking, America's Critical Thinking Crisis, The Failure and Promise of Education. Dr. Stephen J. Perlman is the guest. Also, Dr. Perlman, before we get back to this, tell us about an organization you co-founded, the Critical Thinking Initiative.
Yes, the criticalthinkinginitiative.org is an organization founded by myself and my colleague David Carrillo. And what we're dedicated to doing is bringing our research and techniques for critical thinking out into the world. We are presently offering consulting services and so forth around to various educational institutions and serving the world in that way. But we'll also be launching soon a program that parents can actually purchase for their kids who are in high school or higher that will teach them some direct skills in critical thinking.
The people that came maybe two, three centuries before us, Dr. Perlman, you know, the founders, you could say, but not just in this country, great scientists, artists, writers of literature, painters, music composers all around the world. I read about them. I'm a voracious reader of history from the Middle Ages up till, you know, just years ago. Were these great critical thinkers? And if they were, what made it that way? Was it something that education was doing back then, Dr. Perlman, that's not happening now?
It's unlikely that education was doing something much different for them than it is for our students today. And there are great thinkers still in the world today. There are great thinkers among our students, and many of our children are very smart and so on and so forth. Research identifies a critical difference between the capacity to be smart, but naturally born with a high IQ or some good raw processing power, and the ability to think critically. And they find that when it comes to making stronger life decisions, that the capacity to think critically is actually a greater variable or more important factor than the ability just to be smart. What we're seeing is that we've always had smart people who also learn to think critically in the world. What problem is in modern day, what we're uncovering is that they're not learning to do it in school. Mm. School is not enhancing people's capacity to think critically. Where we think critically more, where all of our students and all of our children think critically more than in school, and this is not a matter of my opinion, this is based on the research and so forth, is everywhere else. They think critically in the, you know, as I give an example, for example, a sandbox with another child or two is a very complex environment. There are social factors to consider and what to do with the sand and who gets the bucket and all these little things, yeah. Even when they're very young. It's a very complex environment. There are lots of thinking that has to be done in that environment.
Yeah.
Now consider the complexity of all that and the richness of it and how much they have to negotiate and figure out and desires and emotions and so forth relative to stepping into a classroom where they're asked to memorize a particular piece of information, or they're sitting for a lecture that's teaching them certain things or what have you. The contrast is stark, and we know that from experiments where they had college students wear portable brain monitors, fMRI machines, for a week that monitored their brain activity, that we saw all kinds of brain activity when students were with their friends at lunch, when they were studying, when they were socializing, and so forth. But we didn't see brain activity in classroom.
Oh,
and that's why we have this problem.
And what? And I know you say you've developed a system here, but what would happen, what would need to happen, Dr. Perlman, in the classroom to sort of jumpstart that brain activity? I know I had great teachers, for example, when I was in college in my journalism school. I couldn't wait to get to some of their classes. I found them funny. I found them engaging. I found the stories they told were fascinating. And others, whatever. If I missed a lecture, it wasn't much. Is that one aspect of this? Is it incumbent on not only having the tools, but for instructors to do what they can do to make it interesting to the students?
That's a fabulous question, and I wish I get asked that more. It's actually very interesting because what we're establishing in the book is a very important premise, that there's a difference between making a student think and teaching them how to think. And we might have lots of professors who get us to think about something that's interesting, but that's not at all the same. And this, I'm speaking from all the research that's been done on this psychometrically and so forth. That's not at all the same as teaching students how to think. That we get them into a lecture or a class and we might engage them in very interesting ideas. And the prevailing misconception that's happening, therefore, is that by engaging students in interesting ideas or getting them to think about things, that we're teaching them how to think of new ideas that other people should think about. And unfortunately, we're not. In fact, and this is very interesting, a very straightforward lecture is proven to be less effective in teaching students the information they need to know than a confusing lecture, a properly confusing lecture.
Oh, I can see overboard. That. Yeah, I can see that, because if it's confusing, the students are kind of, I don't know, awake, saying, hey, wait a minute, I've got to figure this out. Is that what you're driving at?
That's exactly right. It's something called cognitive disequilibrium. And when their brains are kicked into a state where they're slightly confused, they have to think to make sense of things. But if the lecture is so clear that they don't have to think about it, then they don't have to think. And unfortunately, even when we get things that are perhaps funny in class or what have you, those things can also be shown to be a distraction to critical thinking instead of an enhancement of it, even though students enjoy that process on the surface level more. What we need to do as a country is to take steps that other countries are taking ahead of us, very unfortunately, and move our classes away from the acquisition of information, the understanding of what's known, into the capacity for figuring out what the next problems are and how to solve them. So other societies, other countries, and some of them can do it faster than we can, are changing their entire educational structure. So it's not based on figuring out what are the existing bases of knowledge, but they're trying to figure out how do we figure out what the new problems are and come up with new ideas and solve those new problems before we even encounter them.
So give
because
me an
those
example.
Are the societies that want to keep at their head of themselves for the next century.
So give me an example, Professor, maybe one or two societies in the minute or so we have left of who are really getting it, as you say, that really are doing what you said as far as ratcheting this stuff up and really locking in on that. Who should we be looking at?
Yeah, there are a number of them. Finland always does great in terms of critical thinking outcomes. But I think one we have to be very cautious of and aware of is China. Mm-hmm. China, the government, just snapped its fingers a few years ago and decided that all of their learning is going to be based on something called problem-based learning and ideating, which is exactly what I've described to you here in broad stroke. And they're changing their entire educational system around it because they realize that that's how they're going to prepare all of their people to be successful and their country to be successful in the future. Now, China has its own problems in that, cultural problems and structural problems and so forth. But nevertheless, they made that great shift. And obviously, in terms of economics and world power, you know, we have to be very aware of what China is doing. So a lot of the Asian nations and so forth are doing this. And unfortunately, the American educational system, despite a lot of, I think, well-intended rhetoric about a need for this or desire to move in this direction, on the whole, really isn't very quickly.
Yeah, it's like trying to steer a battleship. Yeah, really. Dr. Stephen J. Perlman, thank you. America's Critical Thinking Crisis, The Failure and Promise of Education. Folks, go on the web and check out the criticalthinkinginitiative.org. Dr. Perlman, thank you. Don't be a stranger. Come on whenever you like. We'll talk to you down the road. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. There you go, folks. Check it out. Maybe you want to get it for your kids. America's Critical Thinking Crisis, The Failure and Promise of Education. The criticalthinkinginitiative.org. What did he say? China. I'm telling you. See, they can do that in China, though, because like he said, you know, it's a central government. There's no individual, at least I don't think there is. There's no individual boards of education and curriculum committees. No, the CCP, the CHICOMs, the Chinese Communist Party will say, okay, this is what we are doing. And what did he say? Problem-based or problem-focused education. China. Dan D'Onofrio from the Bridgeport Regional Business Council. And also we check in with the head of the Greater New Haven Chamber of Commerce, Garrett Sheehan, who's with us this afternoon at 4:32. Garrett, Paul here again. Good to talk to you. How are you?
Doing well, Paul. Great to talk with you.
Well, are we seeing, Garrett, is there, since we talked last a few months ago, or are we seeing now, is there a glimmer of light, Garrett, you think, at the end of the tunnel of this whole thing?
Yeah, I think so. I'm in downtown New Haven right now. There's more cars on the street, more activity. We still have a long ways to go. I don't want to say we're all the way there, but you know, warmer weather is going to bring a lot of opportunity as well. From what I can tell, I feel like I talk to more and more people each week who have either taken the vaccine or have appointments, and you know, business seems to be doing well. So you know, it's slow. It's definitely not at the finish line, but the signs all seem to be pointing in the right direction.
And, you know, Garrett, this really is above and beyond anything else, beyond the money, who's getting what money, who can reopen when, how much sidewalk dining can you have, where cities and towns are looking at that all over the state. You know, Garrett, this is going to be just a tremendous mental relief to folks who have to run businesses all to and through Connecticut, Fairfield County, New Haven County, Hartford, when this whole thing is over. I mean, their stress levels, Garrett, are just going to be, look, I'm no doctor, but I can predict a lot better sleeping at night in the short term.
Yeah, people have obviously, for many reasons, health included, but if you're running a business over the course of the last year, it's been an extreme hardship. You know, for some, it was really at the beginning and just the unknown. And fortunately for many businesses, they were able to pick up on something and they were able to do something different, or their business just stabilized. But many others, as we know, especially in the restaurant industry, hospitality, events, other sectors as well, it has been a real slog. You know, you watch those virus numbers, not only to see how the health of our community is, but also indicate whether you'll be able to open and have service. And so, you know, we've had multiple waves of that, and people have really had to stick to it to keep their businesses going through these really difficult times.
You know, Garrett, I don't think anyone really had the scope of, even though they may say it, of how big the prepared food and restaurant industries really are pre-COVID-19. I mean, they were always there. But I talked about this with Dan D'Onofrio from here in the Bridgeport area and also from the Connecticut Restaurant Association, the folks up there. And, you know, people just didn't realize, Garrett, what it would be like not to go to your favorite restaurant, your favorite takeout place for a while, your favorite diner to get that comfort food. And I think that entire industry, Garrett, really has gotten, in a roundabout way, the respect and love that it didn't get for a lot of years.
It's definitely something that we all took for granted. Even in a recession, while maybe some restaurants get hurt more than others, they all still stay open. The really great restaurants still do well. This was obviously something completely different. So to have it completely taken away from us, I think everyone is excited to get out to restaurants. You can still do that right now. My family and I, we've been going to indoor dining for the last couple of months, feel completely safe. But especially when we get more people vaccinated, we can do more outdoor dining. I know we're going to have a lot more people coming out to support those restaurants.
Garrett, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Got to take a quick break. The president and CEO of the Greater New Haven Chamber of Commerce, Garrett Sheehan, is with us. Garrett, back to you momentarily. First, we'll take a break right here, 4:36 on WICC. And a few more minutes with Garrett Sheehan, who is the president and CEO of the Greater New Haven Chamber of Commerce. Garrett, to the money now and to the dollars and cents, because that's what it all really does break down to in the end. We all know that. In your area, are the money problems still there for some businesses, or have the state level and the federal government level initiatives, have they been able to kind of mend the wounds here as we get better, or are there still a lot of businesses who are looking at some long-term financial issues here?
I think it really varies, Paul. Definitely the state and federal stimulus has helped a lot of businesses. It's helped them navigate through a period of time. But, you know, the compounding effect of everything that's happened hasn't fully played out. You know, if you had reserves going into the start, you might have run through those in March, April, May, June of this past year. And so now you're really just hanging in there. Maybe you, if you're in the restaurant industry, maybe you picked up some during the outdoor dining experience. You know, hopefully that was the case, but not for everyone. You know, and then obviously you get hit again in the winter when we lost holiday parties and all those hospitality events that, that help out that industry. So I think that a lot of the stimulus for a lot of the businesses I speak with, it has helped them. It's gotten them to this point, but they're also still in the position of they don't know when they're getting back to normal. And, you know, what even the increased foot traffic that they're having right now is not enough for sustainable for the long term. So there's still many unknowns out there. And definitely the stimulus has helped us at least get to this point. And, you know, and frankly, too, it hasn't helped. You know, not every business has been able to make it here. A lot, it was just too much of a burden, or they just too much defeated by all of the loss of economic activity throughout the course of the last year to be able to get to this point.
So I know, Garrett, it's hard to put numbers or forecasts on this thing, but suffice it to say, probably, what, another year, probably, until we're really, we can really exhale and say, okay, the vaccinations are out there, this is part of our routine now. I mean, we're probably looking at, I would think, what, 9 months or a year before we just kind of say, okay, life is good again. What do you think?
Gosh, I'd have a different job if I could answer that question for you. I think that throughout the pandemic, whatever we thought it was going to be, it's always been longer. So I hate to say that. I just even thinking back a year ago, I think naively, I and many others were thinking, you know, okay, we'll go home for 4 to 6 weeks and then we'll be back on the job. And that obviously turned out not to be the case. I can think of another point in time where I thought September of 2020 was going to be much better. We didn't get there. So I've learned enough to not know what the virus is going to do next. But everything that we're seeing feels very positive. The amount of people that are getting vaccinated seems like it's picking up in pace. And, you know, I'm really hopeful that we're going to be in a better place at the end of this month, into April, into May. I don't know what new normal looks like. You know, I think that for every business, that's going to change. I expect people to come back to offices, but probably not 5 days a week all of the time. So, you know, even when we do hit normal, I'm not sure what exactly normal is. One thing I can say for our businesses, though, is that more so than any other year, they've had to innovate and turn on a dime and adjust to the situation and circumstances. And I expect them, they'll continue to do that because, you know, there is no end in sight of when you have the business perfect. We're just going to have to keep adjusting to the conditions.
Yeah, finally, Garrett, you just touched on it a couple of seconds ago, but I was going to ask you, are you seeing or hearing the rumbles in your area about something that I think we're all reading about, Garrett, is, that full crank of office space we had and still have, many companies have, with nobody there, probably not the way to go in the future. And, you know, what do they do with that space? I see some companies are going to vacate buildings, still own them, and make them into apartments or condos. Are you hearing a lot, Garrett, of concerns about basically empty space, which some of these companies are going to be faced with?
Yeah, there's definitely going to be changes in the office market. Still very unclear what those look like. I've also heard from a lot of employers, you know, they miss being with their employees because, you know, over time, even though we've really adjusted to Zoom and other Teams and everything that's out there online, it really does help to be in person when you can just walk to the cubicle or office next door and ask a question instead of having to try to set up a Zoom meeting to solve a fairly simple issue. So there's just some efficiencies. There's a camaraderie, team morale that you get by being together. So I think that there'll be more coming back to the office than maybe some people anticipate. But I think there'll be a lot more flexibility, too, as people have figured out new routines of how they get work done, and employers are going to be flexible with their employees in how they feel they they get the job done the most. So I think everyone's kind of holding off on many, you know, am I going to make some structural change to the office space? Am I going to switch it over? I think there's still too many unanswered questions out there. And I am hopeful that we will have a lot of people come back because, you know, for a downtown New Haven, it's important to have the college students here, but also all of the office tenants as well.
And let's face it, Garrett, you know, being home is nice, but you can't hit your buddy in the head with that Nerf ball, you know, in the next cubicle. So there's, you know, there's that, you're right, there's that office camaraderie that you just don't have.
It really
is. Garrett Sheehan, President and CEO of the Greater New Haven Chamber of Commerce. Garrett, be good. Good to talk with you. We'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thanks. Garrett Sheehan, President and CEO, Greater New Haven Chamber of Commerce. Yeah, you know what? You know, sometimes you just want to see the folks at work. Now, you may say, well, geez, it's you know, if I don't have to be there 5 days, you know, whatever. But it's going to be interesting. That's going to be the really interesting thing that shakes out from this. And I ask this to all the people that I have on about this area, like Garrett and Dan and Offrey over from Bridgeport or whatever, Bridgeport Regional Business Council. You know, think about what businesses pay for square footage of office space. I mean, you know, those cubicles, if they're empty or if they don't have to be filled in your office 5 days a week, is your boss, does that make sense to pay for them? I don't know. It's going to depend by company. Tony Wong of Fairfield. A couple of things we want to go over. Tony, first, how are you? Hope all is well. And you have a Facebook Live event coming up tonight about a real serious issue that I think more people, Tony, are waking up to. What's that all about?
Well, it is. Thank you, Paul, so much for having me. We're having a Facebook informational forum on the issue related to zoning, affordable housing, and land use bills that are being proposed right now in the Connecticut General Assembly that's going to dramatically impact every town in our state in regards to properties, affordable housing, density housing, environmental concerns. And the problem is there's so many things going on. This has fallen below the radar, unless, of course, you live in a row of colonial homes or Cape's lovely neighborhood, and somebody buys a lot and says, I'm going to use Section 830G of the Connecticut General Statute for affordable housing, and I'm going to put up a 50-unit apartment that's 5 stories long, high, and given the statute protection and the purported proposals being afoot right now, they can do it, and our local zoning boards have no control over it.
Yeah, and Tony, let's not pull punches here. You don't have to. I don't have to, but I'm going to say it. You don't have to. I think we both know, Tony, and I've had numerous people on to talk about this, mainly, Tony, legislators from Fairfield County. And look, there may be some in upper-income areas around Hartford, Farmington, Simsbury, West Simsbury, Avon, all that, maybe some out on the eastern part of the shoreline. But, Tony, I think the majority in the state house and state senate, they've got a bullseye clearly on Fairfield County. And from what I understand, Tony, from what this bill does, part of the penalty process here could be withholding state education money, which to me is like, wow.
Well, the point is there are so many different proposals, and that's why we wanted to do this informational forum. There's probably at least 10 bills in the General Assembly across 4 different committees that have something to do with relations to affordable housing in many factors. There's one that there are actually 6 coming up in the Connecticut Planning and Development Committee, which I'm the ranking member on this Monday. And that's why this informational session is to kind of educate. But Paul, there's so many different scattered bills. It may be a strategy of divide and conquer, but more important is the fact that It just doesn't simply impact Fairfield County. It's looking to affect every community. And let me be clear on this. As a legislator, we in the state of Connecticut have a housing, accessibility, affordability, and diversity issue. We need to address it not only in the suburbs, but also in our urban settings and our rural settings. And the solution can't be Harford telling us and the local municipalities what to do with their zoning relative to schools. It should be a collaborative strategy where neighborhoods, local government, state government, federal government all work together in collaboration with input to make decisions. Unfortunately, all I have been seeing in these proposals coming afoot in the Connecticut General Assembly, led by the Democratic leadership, is a state-mandated takeover of local zoning and land use policies.
And Tony, you know what? One thing I can't stand is duplicity here. And okay, they can legitimately be concerned about that and have discussions on it, maybe ways to make things better. But look at the cities, Tony, and they don't say a peep. A lot of people, I shouldn't, paint with a broad brush. A lot of people, Tony, don't say a peep when you have, these new developers come into Bridgeport and the surrounding area or New Haven and Hartford and say, hey, we're going to make these great new apartment buildings. Okay, they're beautiful. They're one-stop places to live. And the rents, Tony, are clearly way out of the means of a lot of people who live in the cities to live there.
Absolutely. And the same kind of proposal that's going on and focusing on the suburbs do the same thing. Make no mistake about it. Has there been a history of exclusionary social justice and race dynamics in our real estate in Connecticut as well as throughout the country? No doubt. But these proposals afoot that are using the premise, in this case I'll cite Desegregate Connecticut, does nothing to address race dynamics or social justice issues. They're looking to expand capacity and density in building design, and that's the misnomer. Is I got to tell you, if there are solutions that can address the issue, I'm all for it. But this is a one-sided perspective that there's a villain in this, and it's the suburbs, and they have to pay a price. And unfortunately, I think that is too high a price and too patently unfair.
Tony, before we wrap up here with healthcare, one thing that I was told by someone I had on a few weeks ago from the Fairfield County area regarding this bill, or one of the bills here, people that live near, say, the Metro North train line, Tony, they should pay attention because I think one of these bills, Tony, if I remember correctly, does something to zoning within a half mile of train stations or of the Metro North commuter line. Is that true?
Absolutely. Transportation just had a hearing about a week and a half ago. Those same language will now appear in planning and development. So it's appearing in many different places, as I said. It's like a whack-a-mole. Anywhere you look, it may pop up. So the issue is if you live near a transit-oriented development, meaning communities like Greens Farm, Southport, Wilton, New Canaan, and Norotan Heights, that you don't need local zoning approval to build within a half-mile radius of four-unit households. And it can meet it within sewer and water parameters. It gives great leeway for the idea of a transit-oriented development initiative. But for many of the smaller towns with train stations, those are prime commercial property. Those are residential neighborhoods. You're literally, through this bill of a good intention, bypassing all the parameters of the surrounding community. It is, again, good intentions without collaboration of local input is bad policy.
Tony, hang on. We'll be right back with you. I want to talk about what is up with the state getting into maybe more or deeper into the healthcare business. Republican State Senator Tony Wong is with us. Tony, hang on. Let's check forecast now, 5:16. We'll be right back on WICC. Republican State Senator Tony Wong with us for a few more minutes here, updating us as to what's going on at the Capitol. Tony, now more movement, it seems, toward the state getting deeper into the insurance business, the healthcare business. This seems to change day by day, week by week. What's the latest for us?
Well, I can only begin when the government gets involved in anything, run and hide. but look, Republicans and Democrats all agree that lowering health insurance costs is absolutely critical. It is absolutely unsustainable, skyrocketing, so we need to control it. There are three plans afoot. There's one that's proposed by the Democrats and Controller Kevin Limbo that's promising the idea of a public option, a state-run partnership program, which has been in existence for teachers and various other municipal employees that has been in plan right now. But it's a state-run health insurance plan. The governor has proposed an alternative plan that uses reinsurance that is putting a tax on your insurance policies and then also using a comparison pricing benchmarking factor. And the third issue is using prescription drug cost containment measures. And then there's a Republican proposal, what we call a better way, which incorporates the reinsurance which the governor's adopted. We're using the benchmarking feature that the governor has taken feature to. We have also proposed managing and controlling prescription drug costs, which is essential, but far too skyrocketing costs. The fourth factor we put in our plan is transparency, accountability. And the fact is, insurance is an incredibly expensive and complicated product. But if you're going to promise that you're going to cover people and give them the insurance that they need, let's make sure it's viable. The problem is, under the state
Tony,
plan, if it doesn't work, it's in the pocket of the taxpayers.
Well, that's exactly. That's the problem here is all these efforts, Tony, are to be lauded. You're right. But again, and you and I both talked, I think, on the run-up to the deduction of 0.5% for the state's Family Medical Leave Act, and there were people already saying that even after a year of the money that's going to congeal there and start to maybe turn some interest, that will be underfunded. What is the or what are the guarantees, if any, Tony, that if the state gets deeper into the insurance business, they can pay the bills without coming to us for more taxes?
There is no guarantee, and we don't have the numbers right now. And in fact, the latest number that came from the Office of the Budget and Management said that the partnership plan has actually been running in the red. But the most important part of it is you're dealing with people's health insurance coverages. And one of the biggest factors of the Democratic Public Option Program that you're not going to hear a lot about is the fact that people with potentially pre-existing conditions could be adversely selected out of that plan. Now, that was one of the positive things that came out of the Affordable Care Act,
yes,
that anybody with pre-existing condition are guaranteed coverage, which didn't exist in the past. Under the public option, which we don't subscribe to, there is potential cherry-picking and adverse selection that people with pre-existing conditions with high health risks may be precluded from that plan. That's not fair. That's not democracy. If you're providing health care, it's got to be there.
Tony, what about going back to doubling back to what you mentioned about prescription drugs? And forgive me, because I don't know the minutiae of this. I may be right or wrong. Does the state currently, or is there a plan for the state to negotiate with individual drug makers and manufacturers? Do we do that? Do we not do that? Does Medicaid do that on a state level? Is that done at all or not?
I think on a federal level, there is some cost negotiations on that. On the state level, we have not done so. I think it's something that we need to collaborate. The testimony that came out on the governor's bill, which kind of put an excise tax for prescription drugs that rose at a much higher level, was something that brought out a lot of conversation. In fact, it was an incredible honor yesterday in our hearing to have the head researcher of Pfizer come and speak with us in the committee. And I think the first thing we had to say was thank him for all of their scientists in finding the COVID vaccine so quickly. But they were concerned about how business would be impacted in their research and development. So we have to tread very carefully on that. But I got to tell you, what really frustrates me is we got three plans. Let's get the best one. And I like to believe that the Republican plan has a better way. But Paul, you know what's disappointing? Is the fact that we are having a public hearing tomorrow to discuss the Republican bill that looks at reinsurance, benchmarking, prescription drugs, and a transparency component. Mm-hmm. Would you believe that the Senate Democrats have scheduled a vote on the committee to push out their bill without hearing all the different viewpoints.
You know,
you can't,
Tony,
make this stuff up, can you?
Tony, I'm telling you, I tell people this all the time, and I'm on these discussion boards, and I tell people all the time, and even on this show, you know, I say it all the time. They say, well, the Republicans, they cry and bitch and moan all the time, but they're not there with better plans or better ideas. I said, yes, they are, but the other side runs the Senate, they run the committees, they run the House, and the deck, Tony, is constantly stacked. They make the rules, and if they don't like the rules, and look, I know I'd like a lot of people on the Democratic side, Tony, I'm sure you do too, but they take their ball and they go home. It just happens all the time.
They make the rules and they change them when it's necessary. Here's the problem, Paul. I just cited some real good viable solutions, most of which are collaborative with the governor's proposal in concept, right? So why not have a public hearing to engage in that conversation? But instead, our public hearing's at 12. They schedule the vote at 9 o'clock to push their bill out. What are they afraid of?
You can't make it up. Tony, thank you. Appreciate it. Tony Wong, Republican, Fairfield State Senator. Tony, thank you. We'll be in touch.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, Tony. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks. Folks, there you go. There you go. I hear it all the time from people. I hear it all the time. Well, the Republicans don't have any ideas. Yes, they do. But they never see the light of day because, you know, the way the House and Senate work here and the way it works in D.C. Folks, you have to understand, if you are in the majority, you control the process. People say, well, we have the legislative and deliberative process. We really don't. Either here in Connecticut or nationally. Other states, I don't know how other states work. You may have some other states who have general assemblies or state legislatures or legislative chambers who may have different rules. But again, right? They're going to have a hearing, the Republicans are, tomorrow, 3 hours, or shall I say the Democrats scheduled to vote for this 3 hours before the Republicans' hearings. It's just you folks, you can't make it up. It is, here's the bottom line, I've said it before, I will continue to say it. Right now, at least for the last 8-9 years, I know we've had Republican governors before, but where the rubber meets the road, where the sausage is made in the General Assembly, in the House and the Senate, If you are not a Democrat as a voter or an independent, I'm sorry, yes, if you are not a Democrat in this state as a voter, which you can be, God bless you, or an independent leading Democrat, if you don't fall into that category, then you just don't matter. You don't matter in Hartford, and you don't matter in Washington. You just don't. We can talk about, well, there's so many independents in this state and there's so many Democrats and so many Republicans. It doesn't mean squat, Mom. I'm telling you. It doesn't matter in the state House. It doesn't matter in the state Senate. It doesn't matter with our 5 Democratic House members or our 2 Democratic senators. If you're a Republican, you got nothing.